to secure a place as one of the 49 young ladies of that season chosen to make their formal social debut at the famous Bachelor's Cotillion. She had seen the excitement of her older cousin, Anita Warfield, when she came out a couple of years before. Now it was her turn. That her mother was hardly of the first social rank mattered little. It would have taken a brave member of the Cotillion Committee, who chose that year's debutantes, to omit Solomon Warfield's niece from the list of the premier families in Baltimore. By now, Solomon Warfield was viewed as Mr. Baltimore, the forceful and magnetic banker and railroad director credited with regenerating the city after the calamitous fire of 1904, which left the downtown, including his own bank, the Continental Trust, a smoldering ruin. What is more, Uncle Sol had promised Wallace that he would throw a similar party for her as he had for her cousin Anita. Then he had taken over a theater and entertained the great and the good of Baltimore in some style. Wallace could hardly wait, mentally ticking off the days until the big day in early December. With school rapidly receding in the rear-view mirror of her life, she focused on important matters, organizing herself and her wardrobe for her next social engagement. Dances, dinners, and day trips with a laughing group of guys and gals were her daily diet. There would be lunches at the Baltimore Country Club or the Stafford Hotel, oyster roasts and steak at Green Spring Valley, dances at Layman's Hall, or drives out to the rolling country. Carter Osborne was always available to squire her around town, his father's Packard a familiar sight outside her mother's Mount Vernon apartment. Not only did he take her to dances, the deep-pocketed young beau even hired a box at the Lyric Theater, where they saw the Russian prima ballerina Anna Pavlova. When he was not by Wallace's side, he was on the telephone, playing songs by Al Jolson down the crackly line. Her favorite was My Yellow Jacket Girl. It was, as she recalled, so romantic. Every twist and turn of their romance she reported to her confidant and foil, Mary Kirk, either on the telephone or racing breathlessly into her house to tell her the latest. Mary's parents were distinctly unamused by this giddy behavior, the two girls egging each other on. When Wallace accepted a dare to dress as a man and enter the hallowed portals of the all-male Maryland club, they could be forgiven for thinking that she was leading their daughter astray. The fact that they usually went out as a pair meant they could convince their parents they had no need of a chaperone. They pushed their luck. One evening they were chatting late into the night with their beaux on the veranda of Wakefield Manor, the plantation home of Wallace's aunt, Lelia Gordon. Eventually, a bedroom window slid open, and an angry maid cried, "Wallace, send those boys home and come to bed." On another occasion, she and Mary were ensconced in the drawing room at the Kirk household, chatting with two suitors. Suddenly, there was a loud bang on the ceiling as Mary's father hurled his shoes on the floor to signal that the young men should leave. In the dizzy social whirl, Wallace and Mary barely noticed the outbreak of World War I at the end of July 1914. They were having too much fun. Europe was a faraway land of which Wallace knew little. In any case, everyone said it would all be over by Christmas. She and her beau would never have imagined that within 3 years, Carter Osborne would find himself waving a giant Stars and Stripes flag and heading a spontaneous march of thousands in downtown Baltimore to demand that America enter the war. At the time, she had her own D-Day, waiting for the arrival of the coveted invitation to the Cotillion. That October, her relief was unconfined when a stiff envelope arrived announcing that she was one of the chosen ones. "If you don't go to the Cotillion, you're nothing. And if you do, it's so boring," she said later. So boring that it consumed the next 2 months as she agonized over her dress. While white was de rigueur, Wallace went for drama, copying a dress worn by her idol, actress and dancer Irene Castle, who was then starring in Irving Berlin's first Broadway show, Watch Your Step. She posed for fittings, practiced her dance steps in her bedroom mirror, and took tea with fellow debutantes as the big day at the Lyric Theater approached. Escorted by her handsome cousin Henry Warfield and her uncle, Major General George Barnett, she arrived in style, her Uncle Saul lending her the Warfield Pierce Arrow, then the luxury motor car of choice for Hollywood stars and business moguls. Her nagging fear that no one would ask her to dance never for a moment materialized. Wallace tripping the light fantastic until dawn. The round of dances, teas, and parties continued unabated through Christmas and into spring. Wallace eagerly anticipating her crowning moment of glory when Uncle Saul threw a coming-out party in her honor. One day he called her into Solomon's Temple, the nickname for the Continental Trust Bank where he presided, and announced that, because of the slaughter in Europe, he considered it far too frivolous to host a party in these somber times. Much against Wallace's will, he insisted on making a public announcement to that effect, taking an advert in the local newspaper to explain why her debutante ball had been cancelled. Wallace was devastated, feeling that she had been made to look foolish in the eyes of Baltimore society. After all, she had accepted numerous invitations from other debutantes on the understanding that her family would reciprocate. "Naturally, it was a fine gesture on his part," she recalled, "but for a young girl, it was a crushing blow." Though her Uncle Saul canceled her debutante party, her Aunt Lelia felt no such reservations. In April 1915, generously hosting a tea dance for her in the Marine Barracks in Washington, D.C., which was attended by scores of her friends who traveled from Baltimore especially for the grand affair. Whatever the disappointments she felt because of Uncle Saul's decision, she could console herself with the fact that she was still being ardently pursued by Osborne and Stump, young men from eminently suitable and established Baltimore families. In the race to the altar, the determined Mr. Osborne reckoned he could already hear the distant sound of wedding bells, the banker's son believing that he was all but engaged to the Belle of Baltimore. Wallace's family, though, had other ideas. Chapter 2. I Married a Sadist. Captain Henry Mustin looked over the chaotic scene confronting him and shook his head in despair. "Scandalous," he muttered to himself as he reviewed the piles of driftwood choking the wide beach and the abandoned Navy buildings, some damaged during the Civil War, others wrecked by the great tidal wave and hurricane of 1906. Mustin, now 40 but still trim and lean as befitting a one-time world record-holding athlete, had been given the unenviable task of turning this ramshackle spot outside Pensacola on the Florida coast into the U.S. Navy's first air station. "The whole place is in a scandalous condition. I surely have a job on my hands," he wrote to his wife and Wallace's cousin, Corrine Montague, on January 21, 1914, a couple of days after landing in the teeth of a raging storm. "It looks as if it had been abandoned for 50 years and since then had been used as a dump." But Naval Aviator Number 11 was made of the right stuff. Only a few days later, Mustin, who first flew in 1911, and his command of 9 aviators and 23 enlisted men, had cleared the beach sufficiently to house their allocation of 7 aircraft. By February 2, 1914, the runway was built and graded so the inaugural flight could take place. Within 2 weeks of the Navy's first aeronautical school opening, the deadly perils daily facing those magnificent men in their flying machines became tragically evident when Mustin's friend Lieutenant James Murray, Naval Aviator Number 10, drowned after his Burgess D-1 flying boat crashed into the sea from a height of 200 feet. There would be many more tragedies as men tried to master these fickle and frail machines. Mustin led from the front in this perpetually risky business, in November 1915 becoming the first pilot to be successfully launched from a ship by a catapult. For this feat of daring, he was awarded the Legion of Merit. Once the air school was on a firm footing, Mustin sent for Corrine and their two sons and installed them in Quarter A, a historic military building said to be haunted by the ghosts of a previous commandant and his mistress, who perished during a yellow fever epidemic. For a time, the Mustins took their meals at the Old Mill Inn for $25 a month. With her famous Montague charm and gaiety, coupled with a deserved reputation as a Baltimore beauty, Wallace's older cousin soon established a warm and welcoming atmosphere for base personnel, while her adoring, if taciturn, husband ensured the new Navy Aviation School was run in a ship-shaped fashion. She gave it the feminine touch, regularly hosting dinners for the men who put their lives on the line every day. The sound of the crash gong signifying that a pilot had crash-landed was a regular and chilling occurrence. Wallace knew nothing of these daily dangers when she received a letter from Corrine inviting Skinny, Corrine's nickname for her, to spend a few weeks with the Mustin family on the base. The invitation came at an opportune time. It had been a hard winter. Her beloved grandmother, Anna Warfield, died in December following a fall, and she had been wearing the black of mourning ever since. During this time, she had declined every party, turned down every dinner invitation. Her mother had taken the opportunity to write to Wallace's love-struck beau, Carter Osborne, asking him to give her daughter time and space in his headlong pursuit of her hand in marriage. It was the prelude to their eventual parting. Alice was not the only family member who felt that Wallace, still only 19, was racing to the altar in order to beat her rivals rather than because she was with a suitable man. Years later, Wallace put a brave face on this teenage romance. "There was no question of deciding anything. I was too young to be thinking of getting married. It was all for the fun of the thing. In those days, girls were really very moral." At a time when only 3 women in 100 went to college, and marriage was the only surefire route for a woman to win power, status, and stability, Wallace was skirting around the limited choices facing women. Following a family conference in April 1916, it was agreed, albeit reluctantly, that Wallace could break her mourning, pack her party dresses, and take the train south. She would be accompanied by a family friend who would be her chaperone for the journey. The family thought that a few weeks spent in quiet seclusion under the improving wing of Corrine and Henry Mustin, away from the romantic distractions of Carter Osborne and other Baltimore beaux, would bring her down to earth. She would be in the Florida sunshine on a military base in the company of dozens of daring young men in crisp dress uniforms. What could possibly go wrong? Alice realized the moment she received Wallace's first letter that her strategy had badly backfired. Letters from Wallace, who hated putting pen to paper, were perfunctory and peppered with a list of gripes. This time it was different, Wallace telling her mother that she had met the most fascinating aviator in the world at a lunch in the Mustins' home. At a time when World War I air aces like the Red Baron, Albert Ball, and William Bishop were household names, military aviators were the astronauts of their day. In Wallace's eyes, they were godlike creatures who had descended to Earth from a strange and adventurous realm. Her Adonis was aviator number 20, though he was the 18th qualified Navy air pilot. A slim yet rugged young man with flashing eyes and wit to match. Wallace was instantly beguiled by Lieutenant Earl Winfield Spencer, Jr., who, despite holding only the lowly rank of lieutenant, was the base's senior instructor. "Every generation has its own set of heroes, and mine were flyers," she recalled. From a family of 7, with an English mother and an American stockbroker father, Wynne was raised in leafy Highland Park, then a tiny community north of Chicago. He enrolled in the Naval Academy in July 1906 when he was 17. His records indicate he was a decent student, though he certainly seems to have played the class clown, accumulating numerous demerits for talking in the section, skylarking in the college corridor, and smiling in the ranks. He had such a good singing voice that he earned the nickname Caruso, after the Italian tenor Enrico Caruso. When he graduated in June 1910, the student yearbook, The Lucky Bag, described him as brimming with high spirits, a merry devil and a good comrade. There could not be a better shipmate. He first served on board the USS Nebraska before trying his hand at the newfangled art of flying, much to the consternation of his superior officers. In Wallace's eyes, he was a real man, a strong, assured, sophisticated fellow who was in a different league to the teenage boys back home. Impatient in love as she was in life, it took Wallace a mere 48 hours to be hopelessly smitten. I knew I was in love at first sight, yes, but nonetheless, completely, totally, and helplessly. She didn't even care that he only drove a Ford. For the next 8 delirious weeks, Lieutenant Spencer squired her to the movies, to Saturday night dances at the San Carlos Hotel, and even, unsuccessfully, attempted to teach her to play golf. All the while, her cousin Corrine was their chaperone, discreetly making herself scarce when they went shell hunting along the beach so they could have time alone. In true Hollywood style, Wynne proposed as the lights came up at the end of a silent movie. His real-life screen queen was flattered, but asked for time so that she could break the news to her mother, her Aunt Bessie, and the rest of the clan. When her mother gingerly mentioned the time-honored difficulties of marriage to a military man, poor pay, long absences, and frequent moves, starry-eyed Wallace saw the hardships as part of a great adventure. Usually, when she ignored her mother, Wallace was prepared to listen to her Aunt Bessie. Not this time. Wallace's mind was made up. She was determined to snare a trophy husband who would impress her friends and enemies. As Mrs. Merriman recalled, "I told her to stop and think, but she wouldn't. There was no thinking done. She was beguiled by the moonlight, the white uniform, Florida, and flying." Her Aunt Lelia was equally pithy. "You just married him out of curiosity." That fateful summer, when Wynne arrived in Baltimore for a formal family viewing, he charmed the ladies and impressed the menfolk. Even Uncle Saul acknowledged the flyer's down-to-earth manner. The engagement was announced on September 19th, Wallace showing off her diamond ring to as many of her school friends as she could find. Not only was she the first of her year to announce her engagement, but the fellow in question was one of the most glamorous and exotic members of the male species. Later, the competitive Ms. Warfield recognized that her forthcoming nuptials had more to do with the chase than the capture. To be the first was not only a great honor, it was also regarded as very smart and chic. With my ring on my finger, I went all over Baltimore, waving my hand at every opportunity. She had little time to consider the character of the man she was going to marry, his occasional brooding silences, his flashes of jealousy and unpredictable moods. She was too busy organizing her big day. For an anxious few days, though, it looked like the Montague curse would blight Wallace's moment of triumph. The wedding, arranged for November 8, 1916, in Christ Episcopal Church, where Wallace was confirmed, looked certain to be canceled. Just a few days before Wynne was due to head north to Baltimore, his Pensacola naval base was devastated by a hurricane, which flattened hangars and beach workshops, wrecked planes, and battered the control tower. It was such a ferocious storm that offshore a ship sank, drowning 20 passengers and crew. In total, the October 18th hurricane caused more than $1 million worth of damage, crippling the base. With the prospect of America entering World War I growing closer every day, all hands, including Wynne's, were needed in the cleanup operation. In spite of the turmoil in Florida, Lieutenant Spencer and several fellow officers who were ushers were given leave. It helped that Wallace's cousin Henry Mustin was the base commandant. The Baltimore Sun described the evening wedding as one of the most important of the season. Wynne's best man was his brother Dumaresque, a Yale graduate, while Wallace was given away by Uncle Saul, watched by her maid of honor, Ellen Ewell, and chief bridesmaid Mary Kirk, who, to Wallace's delight, caught her bridal bouquet. It would be another 18 months before Mary Kirk walked down the aisle. Like her best friend, she fell for a military man, Captain Jacques Raffray, a French liaison officer who was assigned to Washington when America entered the war in 1917. After all the excitement of her big day, Wallace now found herself alone with her flyer husband. She and Wynne sat in the back seat of Aunt Bessie's car as they were driven to the Shoreham Hotel in Washington, D.C., where they spent the first night of their honeymoon. As Bessie prepared to make her farewells, Wallace whispered plaintively, "Are you going to leave me with this strange man?" Her aunt replied, "Yes, my dear. The rest is up to you." She faced her first night as a married woman, traditionally a moment of nervous trepidation, knowing little about the facts of life. It is ironic that a woman who would become the swirling center of conjecture about her sexual orientation, exotic bedtime techniques, and brazen sexuality, was at the time utterly ignorant of the mechanics of sexual congress. In that, she was no different from the majority of her contemporaries. For all her fascination with the opposite sex, she recoiled in a fluster when Wynne kissed her on the mouth shortly after asking her to marry him, and looked on in disapproval when he pulled out a bottle of gin from his suitcase when they arrived at one hotel room in the dry state of West Virginia during their 2-week honeymoon. Wallace, who was teetotal for the first years of their marriage, pinpointed his heavy drinking as the root cause of the eventual collapse of their union. Yet she admits that she was unduly intolerant of drinking, following in the censorious footsteps of her grandmother. Even her mother found her too rigid, telling guests to hide their drinks when she entered the room unexpectedly. "Here comes Carrie Nation," she would whisper, comparing her daughter to a radical member of the temperance movement. Nonetheless, the first few months at the Pensacola base were a happy time, Wallace fitting easily into the life of a Navy wife. For a girl who had never boiled an egg, it was helpful that Wynne's salary enabled them to pay for a maid and a cook. She learned to play poker. He played the fool, entertaining fellow officers and their wives with his impersonations of vaudeville stars. What amused other midshipmen during his days at Naval College did not find favor with his wife, somewhat prissily frowning on his remorselessly extrovert behavior, his pranks and practical jokes. As her Aunt Bessie later recalled, "He was a showman, an exhibitionist. He would put on a funny hat and expect you to laugh at him. Well, you could laugh one evening, but you couldn't for life." The laughter died in April 1917 with America's entry into the war. In short order, Wynne was ordered to Squantum, Massachusetts, just outside Boston, to set up a new naval air station to train pilots. While he worked around the clock, Wallace, friendless and with time to kill, wandered the streets, visiting exhibitions and museums. She even watched the unfolding drama of real-life court cases, the juicier the better. Her mother's warning that military life was punctuated with frequent absences and constant upheaval was rapidly coming true. No sooner had Wynne got the pilot production line underway in Boston than he was sent to Canada to report on pilot education programs. Then, in the fall of 1917, he was ordered to California to set up a huge new airbase on North Island near San Diego. Though it was a signal acknowledgement of his organizational ability and leadership, Wynne was bitterly disappointed. All the time he was on the East Coast, he had lobbied for a berth on the front line in Europe. He envied his younger brother Dumaresque, who sailed to France in June, and was now combat flying as part of the Lafayette Escadrille Squadron. In spite of his pleading, his superiors consistently declined his requests, informing him that they needed his experience on the home front. As a result, the newlyweds spent their first wedding anniversary shuttling across country to their new berth. They stopped first in Washington, then saw his family in Chicago before spending a night at the Grand Canyon on their way west. On their first wedding anniversary, as they stood on the rim of this magnificent natural wonder, Wynne earnestly reaffirmed his love and devotion to Wallace, his simple words affecting her deeply. She later recalled, "He was neither a poet or philosopher, but there was something touching about the simplicity of his promise that nothing would come between us." There was little time for fine words. From the moment they took possession of a sweet two-bedroom apartment in Coronado, Wynne was working 18-hour days as he and a skeleton crew raced to turn a barren slice of land into an operating Navy airbase. In just 72 hours, he and the men under his command built barracks, washrooms, 5 classrooms, and installed a water and sewage system. Whatever else Wallace may have complained about, there was no faulting Wynne's absolute commitment to the war effort. No sooner was he seeing solid progress in the construction and organization of the base than he was devastated by news from the front line. In January 1918, his adored younger brother Dumoresque was killed. Early reports indicated that Dumoresque, who had already been awarded the Croix de Guerre and Médaille Militaire for his bravery, had been shot down while returning from patrol over German lines. Later, it was revealed that he had been practicing aerobatics and had pulled out of a turn too late. Wynne mourned his brother's death long and hard, the bottle helping to dull the pain. With drink came a barrage of insults and a volley of innuendo about his wife's failings, mainly focusing on her inadequacies in the kitchen. In public, he was jaunty and jovial, in private, brooding, introspective, and morose. It was something of a relief that he left her to her own devices for much of the time, setting off for the base at dawn and not arriving home until long after nightfall. His frustration at being prevented from serving abroad like his brother was palpable, Wynne writing pleading letters to his Navy friends as well as making a formal transfer request to his line commander, Captain Edward Irwin. "I came to San Diego under protest," he wrote. "I wanted foreign service, and have always hoped for an opportunity to fight." Referring to the heartbreaking jobs he had been given, Wynne pointed out that the results of his labors were only apparent when the next fellow came along. Even though Captain Irwin was sympathetic and appreciative of his hard work, sadly, there was no suitable replacement available. While Wynne stewed, Wallace enjoyed the perks that came with marriage to a commanding officer. He had his own Navy barge to ferry him from the mainland to North Island, as well as a chauffeur-driven Packard car. This was more like it. As befitting their station, they were invited to numerous prestigious social events, notably dinner with President and First Lady Wilson at the U.S. Grand Hotel, and a ball in honor of Secretary of the Navy Josephus Daniels and his wife Addie at the Hotel del Coronado. Wallace made a coterie of new friends who would stay with her for the rest of her life. They included Mariana and Rhoda Fulham, the daughters of Rear Admiral Fulham, Rita Chase, the wife of New Jersey businessman Ralph, and later, Catherine Moore Bigelow, a Red Cross nurse who served in France and was widowed just after the end of the war. At that time, she was walking out with William Thaw, the brother of diplomat Ben Thaw. In time, Catherine would play a central role in Wallace's life. As her social life became more varied and sophisticated, she would attend dances at the Cuyamaca Club, bridge or poker nights, and barbecues at the dirigible hangar on North Island. Sometimes Wynne was with her, sometimes not, in which case she would join a party of fellow officers and their wives. When they appeared together as a couple, Wynne and Wallace were showstoppers. Socialite Mrs. E. Clarence Moore was part of a small convivial group sitting in the Hotel del Coronado when Wallace and Wynne walked into the lobby. Our gay conversation was suddenly silenced by the arrival of an unusually good-looking couple who were passing through the casino, she recalled. It was the new base commandant and his wife. After that evening, Wallace and Wynne were frequently in our group, sometimes playing golf, sometimes enjoying informal parties. Even her mother, who came to visit, was impressed with the social life led by the commanding officer's wife. Instinctively, Wallace always put on the smiling mask, the impervious facade that revealed nothing of her inner turmoil and hurt. Though there were opportunities, she said nothing to her mother about her issues with Wynne. As a young girl, she had learned to keep her own counsel. Nothing in her adult life had changed that. For a change of scene, Wallace would occasionally range north with a girlfriend, staying at friends' homes in Santa Barbara and Pebble Beach. Whatever her private concerns, in public, Wallace was the life and soul. Her friend Mariana Fulham describing her as the one person she would love to spend a year with on a desert island because of her vitality and gaiety. Others complimented her on her poise, style, candor, and sparkle, her wit engaging the attention of silent screen comedian Charlie Chaplin and actor John Barrymore when they stayed at the Hotel del Coronado. Harvard graduate Henry Flood Robert remembered Wallace as "darned attractive, though I wouldn't call her a beauty. I found her vivacious and fun-loving. When she entered a room, the focus was on her." Her fabled poise deserted her, however, when she took on the nerve-jangling challenge of organizing her first-ever dinner party at home. Armed with her Bible, Fanny Farmer's cookbook, she invited a young naval couple who lived nearby to act as guinea pigs. The menu seemed straightforward: tomato soup, roast beef, and artichoke. It was the hollandaise sauce that was to prove tricky. As the dinner hour approached, Wallace got herself into such a state that for the first time in 3 years of marriage, she allowed Wynne to mix her a cocktail. It was, she believes, a double martini. While it hit the spot, Wallace was so relaxed that the meal suffered, with most of the sauce splattered on the kitchen wall. Their guests duly arrived. Wynne poured them a cocktail, and Wallace asked them to be seated. Then she opened her Bible and read out the menu she had tried to prepare. She recalled telling her guests, "This is what you were going to have for dinner." Everyone agreed that I had read a beautiful dinner. In fact, it sounded so delicious that we all got up and proceeded to the Hotel Coronado and ordered it. An amusing story, but also revealing about Wallace's elusive character. She told this tale of culinary failure to her ghostwriter Cleveland Amory when she was preparing her 1956 memoir, The Heart Has Its Reasons. He later quit, accusing Wallace of wanting a biography that was more make-believe than real life. Amory's place was taken by Colonel Charles Murphy. In his version, which was eventually published, the evening was a culinary triumph, a night which set her off on her eventual career as an eminent hostess. If this trivial story was deliberately changed to place Wallace in a flattering light, what then of more significant stories relating to her lovers, husbands, and friends? As Foxcroft headmistress Charlotte Noland, whom Wallace considered the model of an ideal woman, told Amory during his research, "I knew her from the time she was a child, and I have never known anyone who could all her life so conveniently avoid the truth." In the world of Wallace Spencer, much was lost in translation. She is not the only one. In the royal world of the House of Windsor, truth, image, and invention are an uneasy linguistic Esperanto. For instance, when the then Prince of Wales first visited Canada in 1919, he met with a crowd in a village outside Toronto. 9 months or so later, the village teacher gave birth to a baby boy. She subsequently claimed the father was the Prince of Wales, with whom she had enjoyed a brief but amorous encounter. It was a story she told everyone until the day she died. On her gravestone, it states clearly that she was the wife of the Prince of Wales. This was a potentially enticing story, except that the same teacher was equally emphatic that she had been awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. For when royalty comes to town, even the clearest memory becomes clouded. A year later, in April 1920, the Prince of Wales visited San Diego en route to a tour of New Zealand, Australia, and all points far east. the golden-haired prince, radiating charm and charisma, held a clamorous reception on board HMS Renown to thank the locals for their overwhelming welcome and their stalwart support during World War I. It was subsequently reported that Lieutenant Commander Wynne Spencer and his wife had been part of the receiving line who shook the hand of the future king. Years later, Wynne even speculated that Wallace may have spoken to the prince. "She was with me most of the evening, but as I recall, she slipped away for a few moments and may have been received by the prince," he informed reporters in 1936. Not to be outdone, the flamboyant Lord Lewis Mountbatten, who joined the prince on his journey, told author Charles Murphy that not only did Wallace meet the prince, but that she subsequently chided him for failing to recall their encounter, especially as she was dressed to kill. In fact, neither Wallace nor Wynne were within 100 miles of the Prince of Wales when his battleship dropped anchor in San Diego Harbor. Wynne was at Marchfield Air Base in Riverside, California, flying land planes and learning bombing techniques. His wife was busy being the life and soul at a polo dinner near San Francisco. On March 31, 1920, according to the local newspaper, she had boarded the Lark Southern Pacific Pullman train for Monterey, where she stayed at Del Monte Lodge as the houseguest of Mrs. Jane Selby Hayne, an outstanding polo player who had recently divorced golf champion Robin Hayne. When not out riding or playing polo, Wallace and Jane Selby Hayne attended numerous dinners and other social events to mark the end of the polo season. Wallace was in her element, captivating a fascinating variety of rich and occasionally available men. She and Jane socialized with Samuel Finley Brown Morse, owner of the Del Monte properties, Australian painter Francis McComas, mining heir George Maurice Heckscher, as well as a pair of dashing English majors who formed the backbone of the national polo team. Historian Benjamin Sachs suggests, "Perhaps the coquetry of Wallace with the several poloists at the Morse dinner dance held in Pebble Beach might have discomfited Isabella, her hostess, Mrs. Luther Martin Kennett, who preferred to close the book on the trip north as a topic of conversation." The suggestion was that with Wynne out of sight, Wallace was at her most teasing. Wallace had always prided herself on her gay and flirtatious nature, admitting that she was brought up to be as entertaining as one can be at a party. She also acknowledged that her husband became an ugly drunk when he watched her behavior at social events. He would lapse into moody silence or become loud and aggressive. Other times he would simply go off on his own into the night. While Wallace attributed the breakdown of her marriage to Wynne's morose personality and the frustration he felt regarding his career, which stalled after the war ended, others suggest her own seductive behavior played a not insignificant part. Even staunch friend Marianna Fulham, later Emery Sands, strongly believed her flirtations drove her emotionally inarticulate husband to exasperation and to reach for the bottle to drown his sorrows. It was not all tears and tantrums. In November 1920, the couple celebrated their fourth wedding anniversary with Henry and Corrine Mustin, Wallace's mother and assorted friends. The Mustins were now back on the West Coast, which was, as far as Wallace was concerned, a blessing. Each time Wynne went away on a variety of temporary new assignments, Wallace nursed the hope that when he returned to their Coronado home, he would be a changed man. Those hopes were usually dashed by day two of his homecoming. She tried to see the sunny side when in August 1921 he was permanently reassigned to Washington to take up a desk job at the Bureau of Aeronautics. His achievements at North Island had been considerable, overseeing the men under his command. At one time there were 2,000 men and officers on the base, who flew 35,000 hours without a single fatality. Not that his Navy superiors appreciated his efforts. When he failed his navigation exam during his bid for promotion to lieutenant commander, the examining board did not consider that for the previous 4 years he had been an active naval aviator and hadn't been near a ship. Fortunately, Rear Admiral William Fulham, whose daughters were Wallace's great friends, personally intervened. Lieutenant Spencer's war work in San Diego, he averred, had been of the greatest importance of any officer in the Navy. Moreover, his position as a junior officer had needed great tact in dealing with fellow commanding officers. He is reserved, taciturn, and abrupt, but this is entirely from embarrassment and diffidence, wrote Fulham. The recently retired commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet went on to state that of all the officers he had met during his career, Spencer was among the first rank because of his cool head, nerve, and high sense of duty. I should not hesitate to assign him to command a cruiser under war conditions. It is my observation that he puts duty before pleasure at all times. With that ringing endorsement, the board had little option but to allow Lieutenant Spencer a second chance at the navigation exam, which he duly passed. He arrived in Washington with a promotion, but little appetite for the political stew that was the post-war Navy Bureau of Aeronautics, as the Army and Navy vied for control. In his heart, he wanted to be back at sea or in the air. Unhappy and demoralized, Wynne, according to Wallace's account, took out his frustrations on her, becoming increasingly sadistic and bullying. On one notorious occasion, he locked her in the bathroom at the Brighton Hotel on California Street where they were staying. Ignoring her frenzied knocking, he went out, leaving her in solitary confinement for hours. She was afraid to shout for help, as the hotel management had already warned them about their noisy behavior. Frantically, she tried to pick the lock with a nail file. Taking Wallace's story at face value, most bathrooms lock from the inside, not the outside, it was an emotionally exhausting and frightening evening. As she pondered her future, she realized that her marriage was beyond repair. She wanted out. In those days, divorce was unthinkable, the financial consequences unpalatable, the social stigma often unbearable. Divorce was only for the very rich or the very foolish. She was neither, but her dire circumstances forced her to think the inconceivable. In Wallace's settled view, Wynne's bombastic personality and his drinking had driven her 5-year marriage to the brink of collapse. Her own restless, impatient personality, her flirtatiousness, and her fierce temper did little to help keep the domestic peace. Wallace recognized that, unlike her mother, who had found the secret of inner peace, she was never really content with anything or anyone in life. Whatever Wynne did was a disappointment, his subdued, introspective personality merely encouraging him to go into his shell in the face of her complaints. It irritated her that he was not blessed with her facility for being able to read people. Within minutes she could see through people, divine their hidden motives and personal qualities. Irascible and impatient, it drove Wallace wild when Wynne could not see or understand that some people did not like him or wished him no good. All he would do was laugh off her warnings or say she was exaggerating. This, though, was nibbling around the edges. At the heart of their marital difficulties was their sex life, or rather lack thereof. Wallace would later confess that throughout her marriage, through the good times and the bad, they had never consummated their union. In an age of sexual ignorance and primitive birth control, her reluctance to engage in sexual congress was not unusual, but still created considerable barriers to marital happiness. Coming from a large family, it was only natural that Wynne wanted to become a father himself. The frustrations felt on both sides can only be imagined. Watching Wallace flirt with other men and knowing he was going home to a stone-cold bed was hardly a recipe for marital accord. It has been suggested by, among others, biographers Anne Seba and Michael Block, that her reluctance to engage in sexual activity was the result of her being born, if not a man, then with ambiguous genitalia, a condition now known as a disorder of sex development, DSD. An early sign is a girl with strong muscles, athletic prowess, long legs, and large hands. Certainly Wallace conformed to this template. Queen Mary's official biographer, James Pope Hennessy, suggested that with her flat, angular body, she was not a woman at all. Over the years, it became commonplace to insinuate that she was in fact hermaphrodite, her sexuality as ambiguous as the conundrum of her eventual appeal to the King of England. She had a hysterectomy for ovarian cancer in 1951, which suggests that she was wholly female. What remains enigmatic is the secret of her sexual allure. In short, what did men see in her? It seems, from the testimony of Herman Rogers, the central male figure in her life, that with her first husband, she enjoyed an occasionally sadomasochistic but ultimately unfulfilling marital ritual. He beat her, and she loved it. Rogers later told Wallace's erstwhile biographer, Cleveland Amory, "Though Wallace has subsequently been described as a dominatrix, with Wynne Spencer she adopted a different role, that of a provocative submissive. Her flirting would be the starting gun for their sexually charged dance. Matters would then escalate, Wallace goading him, a leery Wynne lashing out, his gin-fueled violence perversely viewed by Wallace as a sign that he desired and felt some kind of aberrant passion for the sharp-tongued woman standing before him. Wallace had a temper of her own, and they had frequent yelling matches, and sometimes he would hit her, and she would throw things," her biographer Ralph G. Martin wrote. But when he left her alone, when he chose not to speak to her for sometimes a day at a time, this she could not tolerate. At least violence was an acknowledgement of her existence. This was, though, a dance without consummation, frenzy without resolve. It was the last sick, hopeless dance of a doomed romance. She was learning the hard way that she had fallen in love with the glamorous image, not the man, and that for a long time their union had been shored up by their brisk social life and her supportive circle of mainly female friends, and padded out with his frequent deployment on Navy business. Much as Wallace would have hated to admit it, her mother was right. There was no romance in marrying a Navy officer. She had fooled herself that she was in love. Ruefully, she realized that her real motivation had been to beat her Baltimore contemporaries to the altar. In her immaturity, Wallace had made a catastrophic mistake. Eventually, she sought out her mother, then working as a hostess at the Chevy Chase Country Club in Maryland, and explained that she wanted a divorce. Even though she never mentioned the embarrassingly intimate details, her mother was as horrified as if she had confessed to murder. She was not appalled at her son-in-law, but at her daughter for even contemplating such a step. Neither a Montague nor a Warfield had divorced in 300 years. The very idea was preposterous. Unthinkable was the mot juste. Practical as ever, she also pointed out very firmly that as a divorced woman, Wallace would face social disgrace and financial ruin, not to mention the shame she would bring upon the family. Separation, possibly. Divorce, never. Wallace faced the same mortified refrain when she called upon her beloved Aunt Bessie, now living near her sister as a paid companion to a well-to-do spinster. While Bessie would later concede that Wynne was a sadist who she could not live with, at the time, she was in lockstep with her sister. As Wallace, shaken and subdued, contemplated their reaction, she realized that they were from a generation where women had no status or rights, their lives utterly governed by the whims of men. The war, especially the introduction of millions of women to the workforce, was splintering those moral absolutes and placing a generation of mothers and daughters into conflict. In the 19th century, virtually every campaign, from temperance to female emancipation, was cast as a mother-daughter alliance. In the 1920s, after the war had left the world, as cartoonists frequently depicted it, in crutches and its arm in a sling, That alliance crumbled before a consumer-driven revolt of young women against prudish Victorian matriarchs. Life was, according to feminist writer Susan Faludi, a celebration of a motherless girl culture of flapper dance-a-thons, petting parties, and gin fests. The powerful new forces of Hollywood, national advertising, automobiles, and urban jobs enlisted young women into a commercial version of emancipation. While the Jazz Age presented an image of beautiful people buoyed up on bootlegged champagne bubbles, the new decade promised young women like Wallace in the Ain't We Got Fun generation the freedom to shop, display their bodies, and to smoke, to drink, and drive with the boys, and throw it in the face of their mothers. Post-war America was a jittery, restless nation, a sink-or-swim democracy bobbing about in an ocean of insurrection and revolution. Living for the moment, morning, noon, and night, was the mantra of the bright, young, wealthy things who could afford to buy those special candles that burned at both ends. This reckless, devil-may-care attitude was exemplified by the Roaring Twenties couple, novelist F. Scott Fitzgerald and his beautiful wife Zelda, who were notorious not only for their prose, but also their propensity for leaping into fountains at Union Square and in front of the Plaza Hotel in New York. While the Big Apple had taken over from exhausted London as the premier city for conspicuous consumption and excess, the noise and values of the blaring Jazz Age had not spread far beyond Manhattan. Arguments about changing social mores and the independence of modern women still cut little ice in Uncle Sol's Baltimore Bank, where Wallace was forced to swallow her moralizing medicine from the man whose good name meant everything. He railed against the very idea of divorce. "I won't let you bring this disgrace upon us," he thundered, before ending his peroration with a request that she give her marriage one more try. She did as she was bid, hoping against hope that Wynne would be jolted to his senses. It was but a brief reprieve. After spending yet another night wondering what Wynne was doing when he failed to return home, drink, or another woman, or both, Wallace had had enough. She asked her mother if she could move into her apartment at 2301 Connecticut Avenue. Reluctantly, her mother agreed. Wynne was resigned to his fate. When she told him her plans, he said, "Wallace, I've had it coming to me. If you ever change your mind, I will still be around." The die was cast. For Wallace, this was a brave and bold move, eschewing safety, status, and security for a very uncertain future. Comfort came from an unexpected quarter. On October 18, 1921, she received an anguished and heartsick four-page letter from her mother-in-law, Agnes Spencer. While Agnes acknowledged that her son's disposition did not make him the easiest person in the world to get along with, she recalled her visit to see them in Pensacola, where "your wishes and happiness were his first consideration." She finished sadly, "I wish I could do something to mend matters, but I fear that there is little to be said or done." Wallace's husband, a gentleman to the last, added his own postscript to their marriage when he was tackled by reporters during the abdication crisis in 1936. Nursing a broken leg from a fall on ice, he told the assembled throng, "She is one of the finest women I have ever known. My work did not allow me to partake of the social life which Wallace loved so dearly. Gradually, we drifted apart. I suppose that is the price we pay for a career. She was the leader of the social life at Coronado, but became lonely during the times I was at sea with the fleet." Shortly after Wallace walked out, Wynne finally got his wish to return to General Navy service. Just before Christmas 1921, he was ordered to join the USS Chaumont and take this slow boat to China and join the American fleet. If Wallace was all at sea regarding her future, Wynne was returning to his first and perhaps only love, a life on the ocean waves. Chapter 3. He was simply irresistible. Courtney Letts's first memory of Washington was of when she was just six, and she joined the other children of the wealthy and influential at the traditional Easter egg roll on the White House lawns, her activities watched by the benign, mustachioed figure of President Theodore Roosevelt. As the granddaughter of a U.S. senator and daughter of Frank C. Letts, president of the National Grocery Company, who supplied foodstuffs to the masses, privilege and status were her birthright. When she was a teenager, she taught the nervously dapper F. Scott Fitzgerald how to ice skate, and later invited him to join her family at their country estate at Lake Forest in rural Illinois. He arrived complete with his own electric curling iron to wave his hair, and when he was eventually dressed and ready, she took him to several parties. The loquacious aspiring writer was, according to her friends, a terrific success. It was Courtney who introduced the novelist to her beautiful friend, Ginevra King. He promptly fell head over heels in love, his golden girl becoming for a time his romantic interest and his muse. She was the template for the flirtatious yet distant Daisy Buchanan, the anti-heroine of The Great Gatsby, the classic American novel that captured the spirit of hardness and hedonism of the Jazz Age. When Fitzgerald so brilliantly described a post-war world where the social elite lived with the insouciance of grand dukes and the casualness of chorus girls, he was thinking of Courtney, Ginevra, and the other gilded youth who comprised their social circle. Years later, he sent Courtney a first edition of his first masterpiece, This Side of Paradise, complete with a long dedication. "You will probably find yourself and your mother in it," he wrote. "I hope you will not mind what I wrote." Courtney, Ginevra, and two other beautiful Chicago friends, Margaret Peg Carey and Edith Cummings, a brilliant golfer dubbed the Fairway Flapper, were known as the Big Four, a quartet blessed with beauty and social brilliance. Their daily doings were lovingly celebrated by the mass circulation media. As Fitzgerald described, they had class and certainty, that effortless sense of privilege born out of wealth, and what the English aristocracy liked to call breeding. They didn't need to try as hard, floating through life as if to the manner born. As the man himself observed about the very rich, "They are different from you and me." When Courtney Letts drifted languidly through the social whirl of Chicago, Washington, and later Paris, it was remarkable how often her life intersected with the less rarefied world of Wallace Spencer. Though the two women did not formally meet for a quarter century, they were the fiercest of love rivals, for a time Courtney becoming Wallace's romantic doppelganger. Not only were they wooed by the same men, they were often mistaken for one another, though Courtney was more conventionally feminine and rounded, whereas Wallace's features were hard, masculine, and angular. And it was Courtney who was chosen by the Chicago Tribune as one of the 12 most beautiful women in America. Wallace was not on the list. Before Wallace moved to Washington, both women had married impetuously to handsome and handsomely attired Navy officers. Both were now separated and looking for a way out. Unlike Wallace, Courtney was a mother to two children. For a time, they lived a short walk from one another. Courtney and her children stayed with her mother at number 2342 Massachusetts Avenue, a substantial 5,800-square-foot brownstone on what was known as Diplomat's Row. Wallace shared rooms with Alice at the 8-story Carthage apartment building on Connecticut Avenue. They were both cast from a feminine mold of the pre-war era, women who didn't or couldn't work and subsumed their own ambitions in their pursuit of a wealthy husband or benefactor. Wallace and Courtney had married young, trying to impress their peers rather than make a sensible choice. Wounded by their folly, they were not about to make the same mistake again. As Courtney's granddaughter, Courtney Hagner, observes, "Nana was so like Wallace in many ways, always able to put on a perfect front, and if there was any issue, to disguise it." They may have lived near to each other, but socially they were worlds apart. Where Courtney effortlessly glided into the best parties, the the fanciest dinners and the ritziest receptions, Wallace had her nose pressed firmly against the window, desperately looking for a way in. When Courtney went to the Chevy Chase Country Club to improve her tennis backhand or meet friends, it was Wallace's mother as one of the hostesses who was there to greet her. By the time Wallace was noticed by Courtney, she was no longer living with her mother. In a secret diary written by Courtney and revealed for the first time in this volume,